Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Beyond Dimensions. Today I am very happy to be chatting to Fang Xu, who is an associate at Fosters & Partners. Fang has some really lovely stories about how the use of 3D visualization at the early stage of coming up with an idea has been used to engage a whole plethora of stakeholders and get them really involved in that co-design right at the start of a project. So Fang, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So would you like to give us a little introduction to yourself and how you got to Fosters, and then maybe we can talk about Watertown?
Sure. I would love to. So I started my career in Shanghai, China. I studied architecture there and then practiced as an architect for a few years there. Then moved to the United States to pursue a doctoral program in architecture. My focus at the time was social and cultural factor design. So it's a long story for me to explain how I transitioned from that direction, which is more related to anthropology and psychology. And then eventually I found my passion in the field of 3D visualization. And then I was later on, I started to teach at two universities. And then after that, I moved to the UK and then start work for Fosters & Partners. And currently, my main role in the company is to lead the development of all kinds of what I call digital narrative tools that help our architects to explain very complex design decision-making procedures to the client, to build a trust and then to help them understand the value of our design services.
Wow. And so actually, before we get into Watertown, what sort of, in terms of that digital narrative stuff for your architects, what sort of things are you using 3D visualization to help communicate?
We use Unreal Engine. So this is actually original. People think Unreal Engine is about the tool, a platform we use to build games. But actually, we are actually in this newly found kind of territory that we can use the tool to build those interactive 3D apps or gadgets, whatever you call it, that layperson can play with that, and it can run any computer, can run different platforms, even remotely through iPad or smart devices or something. So that we typically use those digital narrative apps during design conferences when our clients came to the office to talk to the architects. They don't have to just go to the computer screen and then looking at those, you know, for them a little bit kind of bizarre and confusing kind of icons and symbols, everything. They can just play the tool, start with something very sort of, it's like sometimes when you install a program, there is a wizard, you can just have step by step to follow. So the app would do the same thing, just in a very user-friendly way to help you understand what this project is, what we're proposing, what options we have, what important decisions we make. And these are scenarios like you are having if you actually make those decisions. And in the process, what's important is our client can have hands on it. Actually, they can manipulate certain beginning conditions, like what if you actually opt for a different decision at some point of design, what the result is, what the numbers will be. They can find out that very quickly. So instead of in a very linear way that when our architect to show them slides and images and visualization, all the presentation is what I call a script, actually. Basically, it's just a one-way communication. Even if you encourage the client to ask questions to the procedure, they would rather not interrupt it. So the communication is not a very two-way or very kind of effective. By using this kind of interactive platform, the communication is always mutual. And then we feel that the clients have been actively participating. They feel empowered. They feel they don't have to speak the language of the professions like architects, but then they be the values, their opinions are valued, and they've been part of this decision-making process. If they heavily feel that they be involved in the process.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. It's interesting. The last podcast I did, which was with Alexandra Powell, she's the managing director of Powell DC, which stands for the Design and Construct. And they're a smaller architectural practice than Foster's, but also finding the same thing in that if you provide that visualization at the start, not it just allows people to understand what it is that they are almost, I suppose, signing up for. Whereas and an inevitable part of that is the fact that it doesn't have to be linear. You can go and explore, which makes it even more engaging.
Exactly.
And I suppose that leads into quite nicely the Watertown experience that you told me about. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that Watertown experience. And the amazing things that happened with it.
Yeah, the Watertown story started in 2018. Sorry. So I was an architecture teacher at the State University of South Dakota at that time. So I led a class of, I actually led two classes of students to Watertown, first in an undergraduate class, about 19, 18 students, secondly, a graduate class, about 12 students. So Watertown is a small rural town in South Dakota, in the heart of South Dakota, but it has a very decent 8-block historic downtown area that has about 60 buildings listed in the National Register of Historic Buildings. So, and the local people are proud of that for a lot. But then, just like many small rural towns in Middle West, you know, they'll be experiencing a sort of deterioration of downtown area, you know, because more and more people just drive car around, and then we see fewer pedestrians using the downtown spaces. So they've been talking for over 20 years. They've been talking about how we can revitalize our historic downtown. It is so beautiful. It has so many nice buildings dating back to 1850s, 1860s, you know. And then there is also some cultural events that, like for example, feather hunting, you know, and those kind of cultural events that would attract tourists to the town. But then people often find that the tourists would, instead of going to tour the nice downtown, they would just find a hostel just far away in the outskirts of the city, which is a little bit you don't feel people, a lot of people swarm to the town during those events, even though there are actually lots of visitors. So people don't feel there's a sense of celebration if we don't see large crowds of pedestrians using the downtown area. So that's a kind of the initial drive of downtown revitalization. So they consulted lots of planners, architects, and then as a public school, I think it's a responsibility for the South Dakota State University to engage the community there. So I propose a multi-year sort of plan of so-called community participatory design, and Watertown is a place we picked as a base. So we went there many times. We start to engage people there, get connected with both political leaders and community leaders there. The idea I propose is, I want to build a game. I want to build an interactive design game that lots of regular people can participate. They can have their opinions expressed through the game. We can see the results. And then we can modify the result, sort of the form generated in the game immediately on site, instantaneously, so we can see the change we're making. That way, I think it's the best way to communicate. Because the problem I detect at the moment in many so-called participatory design is there is some sort of difficulty in communicating ideas across the professional lines. Many laypersons, if they're not from the design backgrounds, they struggle to understand drawings, especially plans or facades, actually. Even if you show them rendered, 3D rendered, visualized, sort of printout renderings, they will still be imagining, you know, what the building should look like from a different angle. Mm. You know, what does it feel if I stand in front of the building instead of just looking at, you know, 50 feet away, you know, something like that. They have those questions. And also, they are quite a respect. They respect the architects a lot because these people bring drawings, models, travel miles to their town, and then do the presentation. They're just too respectful, and then just feel reluctant to challenge the. Some people would say, "I just don't like your design. I think it looks awful," but they cannot articulate their language to explain how it can be improved, or what exactly in their mind that they want the building to be like. So these are all the challenges we're facing. Okay, we're trying to empower these people. We try to really sort of get them involved. We want to consult them actually about what they really think that the design should be. We value their opinions, but then it's hard to pick their voice. So there's actually, we need a translator, interpreter in the middle. And then we think the digital tool will build a digital 3D game can play that role. So yes.
It was really, sorry, I was gonna say, what strikes me as really interesting just about that piece is the starting point of, you know, this small rural town in South Dakota, mm-hmm. that is, you know, I suspect not used to seeing 3D visualization, certainly not used to interacting with it in a gameplay situation. That must have been quite a fascinating experience to produce this piece,
this interactive
piece, and get it out to them and sort of step back and see what happened.
Exactly. I'm going to show you later. I'm going to send you a picture of the front page of the local newspaper, showing an image of the game and also the reporting the whole story, everything, you know. To set up those kind of community engagement events is not easy, actually. It takes lots of logistic concerns to decide what date and time is appropriate in a year, not too cold and not too warm, not too busy. You know, as I explained, they have this feather hunting season that lots of people cannot attend. And they will be busy sort of having fun. So we pick those dates. I think it's in late September, early October, something. The weather just mild, and then pick sometime a bit after six, so that most people will be off work. But still, in our first meeting, we see 80% of attendees are seniors. They just, you know, I think the people are just freer and then maybe just have interesting many things, actually. More participatory in a general sense, where younger generations may not care in that much. But after we use a game, something just amazing happened. You know, when we return the next time, we see lots of a full range of age groups start to attend, because the children of those seniors attended the first session, and their grandchildren all swarm to the nice city council hall, and they just want to check out the game, actually. And then they all had fun, actually. So I have 12 students in total. So these students form groups of two. They build six games. I also build a game, so we have seven games in total. So we set up like a seven booths, just like in a science fair kind of style. And then people just roam around and try different games, because they generate different things, actually. They have different kind of setups, actually, and parameters are applied in different ways. But all the games have something in common. First, you can sort of manipulate the many detailed parameters, like building height, you know, how many floors, how many rooms, major materials, window proportions, those kind of things, to generate a building design. Or there is some templates you can pick, like more modern, more traditional, mixture, freestyle, those kind of thing. And then what are the factors you weigh more? Like, for example, you want to have more kind of material similar to the neighboring building, or you want to have some proportions of the window that are actually compatible with the neighboring buildings, or you want to have more street level kind of activities. And then you can enter those inputs and then press a button and then you generate something. I need to clarify, there's no AI involved in this procedure at all. It's all just, you know, using the preset matrix then just sort of compile all kinds of input parameters, the general form. This is something students can't handle. I trained the graduate students who had no backgrounds in Unreal Engine at all, and just by learning the blueprint system, which is a visual scripting system. And then they start to build those amazing products, although the process was not easy, but then they made it at the end. And then they did a successful field trip and engaged the local residents here. So what is particularly memorable to me is some students telling me that in the past, when we took a design course in architecture school, we were, in the very beginning of the semester, we were handed a sheet of paper telling me these are the the spatial program of the project. These are rooms you should actually include in your final design. And then we got no chance to talk to the actual people that who might be influenced by our design. The project too hypothetical, you know. Even if it's a real world project, we got to talk to people. It was not very kind of, as I explained to, earlier, the communication was not two-way. You learn something from them, people, and then you'd be guessing what they actually meant. Or when you inform them, these are things we're going to do, people just nod along and without really paying that much attention. So this game nights actually we had with the local people really changed everything. It's the dynamics really kind of encouraging and then just heartwarming. And you can learn that from the newspaper reports actually about those events. You know, that people are saying, okay, it's the first time I feel that my voice being heard, or I know I got a chance to say something that those architecture students, although they're doing this profession that I don't understand very well, but I got a chance to explain my ideas, you know, through the game. So
I was gonna say, and also, I mean, what you're also doing is just if children are getting involved, you're inspiring them to maybe even consider design as a career, whether that's architectural design, whether it's spatial design, which is
absolutely.
Did you take? So you ran a number of these nights, I guess. Did you? How did you use the data or the interaction with the games to inform the ultimate design?
Yes, actually the ultimate product is not a specific design, is to help the city to enact a design guideline for new downtown developments. So for all future buildings that will be erected in the downtown area, they should follow those formal rules. Like for example, the number of amount of openings on the ground floor, those kind of things. So, I think the most productive night is the final night, and then when we actually the games were all sort of finalized, brought to the site, and then people had a happy 1.5 hours playing those games, and then we generate over 200 most voted actually outcomes, and then we print them up in a matrix style, and then just sorted, and then post on the website of the city, and then. Those people who didn't got a chance to attend, they continue to vote on those things, and they were further narrowed down to a few kind of options that most favored, the most favored ones and the least favored ones. So that give us some direction, or give us some important feedback. Okay, these are things that people like more, these are things people don't like. And then these all results are visual. They are not just a verbal text, because verbal text sometimes can be very confusing. It means very different things. To people with different backgrounds, you know, but visuals, if you agree with that, this is what you want, actually. There'd be no ambiguity, actually, in that. So we actually run this through the social media, through the city website. So there is, after we left the town, there's this ongoing kind of sort of digesting process of the materials we actually generated. And all of those seven games actually still kind of sort of transported to the city. So if in the future they want to run it, use it to some extent, they can still use it. We pick one particular site on the city. It was currently a furniture store, but it was deteriorated as well. So most of time it was not open. And then the owner is considering sell it. So the city wants to sort of find a buyer of the property. And then there may be a developer in the future to bid for the site. And then we've been proposing, what if we build a hypothetical, you know, boutique hotel in this area to attract all the, as I said, the tourists, you know, even if they're seasonal, just for the hunting season, actually. I mean, just invite them to stay in the downtown instead of some, you know, Motel 6, you know, 30 miles outside of the city, you know. So bring people there, give the city a bit feel of celebration and festivals, you know. So that's the whole story, yeah.
Sorry, go on. I was going to say, what year was this? Did this activity take part?
The game nights happened in 2020, but everything started in 2018, actually. I spent quite a few years here, yeah.
So did that? So has that sort of that brief or set of guidelines that came out from your exercise, has that now been adopted? Is that now in place for Watertown and any development within it?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I kind of answered that. I wasn't following up after I moved to the United Kingdom. Okay. I occasionally had an email exchange with the mayor. She told me that we've been kind of making good use of that. I don't know if it's just a polite response or that's a fact, but I kind of check up anymore. So my career change definitely disrupted this procedure. Otherwise, I would definitely follow up. But that's another story. Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be really fascinating to see, because that to me seems like such was not that simple, but such a beautiful and relatively simple thing to do, to engage communities that wouldn't normally would be so far removed from having an opportunity to share their thoughts, but also in doing it because of the way that you've done it, it's accessible to everyone, and not only accessible to everyone, but it creates desire in people wanting to come down and do it. So you're getting, it's like a force, it's like a feedback multiplier. Simple solution has gained so much traction and therefore so much feedback that you're getting exceptionally rich data from it that is incredibly valuable. It's something where I live in Yorkshire, a place called Shipley, there's a market square which has been in decline. It's an ancient market square, but it's been redeveloped and over the years, and the last sort of 15 years it's been in real decline, and they've got propositions and proposals about what they want to do with it. And it strikes me that this would be, in fact, I am, once this video comes out, I'm gonna tweet it out to the mayor of West Yorkshire, Tracy Braman, and see if we can do this, because it strikes me as just such an obvious and fantastic thing to do. And it'd be lovely to see if it had been used, if anyone else, any other councils in the States or anyone else has adopted it as a result of this.
Yep, absolutely. Yes.
So one of the things that I always ask people at the end of the podcast is, you know, what their thoughts are regarding how 3D visualization will be adopted in 2030. And I think you've got quite a really interesting perspective, because on the one side you've got this sort of, you know, the grassroots exploration with engaging, like normal pedestrians, let's say, stakeholders. And then you've got your work at Foster's, which is a completely different, you know, set of stakeholders and, you know, massive development. So you've seen both ends of it. How do you think 3D visualization, or the use of 3D visualization, will evolve it by sort of 2030? What do you think the key things we'll see are?
Well, I think actually the key things is actually the users of 3D visualization, especially the designers, they should change their opinion about what that is. In the past, they see that as a post-design sort of procedure, like when my scheme has been finalized to some extent, which are milestone something, then I still export my 3D model into some visualization platform and get it rendered with the sound materials. What I've been promoting all the time is either visualization in real time or what I call in-design visualization. Like as your design proposal is being evolved, the visual 3D visualization should be in place. This is give the designers some immediate feedback as well, give them some incentives. And then ideally, this should not be, when I did the presentation in London's Next Build kind of conference, I emphasized that point again. Human eyes are more sensitive to moving objects rather than to, if you actually place a 3D object in an absolutely stable kind of still image, there's no way even for people to judge the distance or if it's not rotating or moving or something. Because your two eyes are constantly doing triangulation to determine depths of kind of key information. And if the object is moving, even if you just have one eye, you can still feel it's 3D actually. But then the people actually are in architecture school, because just like we have this huge path dependent thing. Originally, renderings were created manually as a still image, manually. I used to teach watercolor when I was in China, because we render buildings, doing building renderings with brushes.
Wow.
Literally. Yes. Wow. Literally. Yeah. So, and later on, when we actually moved to the 3D environment, what impressed me first is games. I can recall some famous games in the 1990s by Carmack, you know, the Quake, you know, Doom, those kind of first-person shooting game. What impressed me most is you can roam around in 3D environment and see the design in multiple, in different angles at different speed, you know. So that's actually really give me a better understanding what the space is. Actually, it's much better than the still image. And then I think that when you observe something or you want to evaluate how the space would have some effect on human behavior as a perception, you have to engage the object in a dynamic 3D kind of setup. You cannot stay at a fixed sort of distance to the building and then just take a picture. You got to move back and forth, rotate, roam around, you know. You have to do those things, actually. And better from the eye level, a regular eye level, not from a drone's kind of viewpoint or something like that. So these are the key elements in the game I build, actually. When people actually enter the game, they can get the actual immersive view for an ordinary pedestrian walking on the street. They can see how many steps I can take to get close to the building. You know, if I look up, what I'm going to see. If I go to the balcony and look out, what I'm going to see. It's always like you're roaming around in the environment. You're part of the environment. You're completely immersed in the space. That's a kind of the elements that we should emphasize more, actually. While the current, if you talk about barriers, I think on the technological side, actually, our sort of rendering or visualization programs, most of them, they are still thinking about, we just do the, still producing the conventional sort of paradigms of still renderings or imagery. Mm. Many of them, I don't want to name names, but many of them still thinking about that, okay? They're not thinking about interactive space that people can walk into it and start to experience it. It's not, at least not their priority, actually. That's, I think, that people should change, actually, for those people who actually develop the rendering tools. For the people who use their rendering tools, like architects, whatever, they should also change their mindset. They should think, okay, you cannot just actually do rendering after a few weeks into design. You got to do it on day one. You got to do it on day one and from a very primitive massing stage. You should think about, you know, this is thinking about you create something behind a curtain and it's just a large volume and then just and then gradually you make it add more details to the volume and then turn to something. So it should be a constant procedure. You're doing visualizing every second of a design. So these are two small observations I can make right now. Well, I can definitely see that some tools like Twinmotion is sort of moving to that direction. At least you can immediately get some environment you can roam around, actually, and then it becomes embedded into the modeling program. People can do sort of instantaneous sort of visualization procedure as well. But I feel that people are not using them enough, actually, or more frequently. They're still thinking this is actually some step I can take later on after I drafted my scheme. This is all related, also related to the education experiences they had in architecture school. Some professors would sort of say, telling students, don't do any renderings until you're confident your form is determined, or you should do some physical models and then decide a form and feel you like it, and then you go to computer to render it. These comments were all based on their past experiences, okay? So these advice might have its values in a, you know, working environment 20, 30 years ago, but may not be that actually relevant right now. So, yeah.
Because that's exactly, I used to be the co-director of the design program at Queen Mary, and that was looking at more sort of product and industrial design. And I would say exactly that. I would always say, look, you've got to start with sketches. So, you know, rubbish sketches, and then bigger sketches with more detail, and then basic sketch models, and then higher fidelity sketch models before going to a render. And the reason for that was that I wanted people to consider the detailing first, but also when you present, if you present a render, there is an expectation that that is a completed thing. That if you, but and that if there's anything that's on there that shouldn't be on there, you're gonna, as say a client, you're gonna be affronted by it. And if there's anything missing, you're gonna be annoyed. But I think that's really a case now, potentially, of you just need to contextualize it with the audience first and say, look, this is a working progress window. Look, we haven't included this detail. Going back to what you're just saying about the future, and I think one of the things that Amutri, one of the reasons that Amutri exists is for that democratization of 3D, is to make,
yep,
make 3D visualization as accessible as possible, because you don't need, you do it through a browser, you don't need to know Unity or Twinmotion or any rendering package. You can just drop your CAD and it renders it in photorealistic 3D as a beautiful, mm-hmm, experience. So I think that's one of the issues generally is at the moment is because the skill sets required traditionally are maybe not available to an architectural practice, but certainly expensive. That hasn't been, you know, that hasn't been necessarily achievable. So until later on in the process where you're confident that there's going to be some value add because you're spending a lot of money on it. So hopefully now with Amutri we can bring that forwards. But the other one that I think is interesting is how, in your vision of the future, how VR will play into that. Because if you've got, it's all well and good looking at something in 2D, and you can get 2D that's moved, it's 3D but it's shown in a 2D screen, you can get an understanding of some of the space there, but the, mm-hmm, but an even better understanding is with virtual reality. Do you think it's inevitable that there will be a VR play in 2030? Or do you think that there's still an issue with getting VR into the hands of stakeholders and the people that need to use it?
I can see there is an issue with VR, current VR technologies and VR use right now, which is actually it does not promote any social interactions at all. And then maybe not really to that extent or effective way to get more people involved in the same virtual environment. Because we did those kind of experiments in South Dakota as well. We brought a physical model to the community, and we brought VR as well, actually. And the more people gathered around the physical model, they pointed at the model and looking at it, and then laugh and then chat and everything. While when you are put on the VR headset, it's you alone and other people just guessing what you're looking at. Even if they have a sort of a desktop projection of the visual images, it's not the same as you can see the 3D in the VR environment. So so during the game nights actually we had there, because we just use computer, people just bring laptops there. So I can see people gather around and just looking at one people playing the game, other people just making comments around, they're all participating in the same process. So I'm actually thinking about other technologies, sometimes thinking maybe 3D TV or 3D monitor technologies or hologram technologies, or if there's any way that we truly can have more people comfortably and conveniently immersed in one virtual space. Sometimes we saw those kind of publicity kind of posters of VR. You see the kind of hologram avatars, in the same space, but actually it's not exactly what people experience. Actually, what you see is a bunch of people in a conference room putting the plastic thing on their head, and then I actually try to kind of sell VR technologies and or procedures to some clients when I was in South Dakota. Some people don't like to put on the VR headset; they feel it looks funny, and also, especially I remember there's one female CEO of a design firm. She just always refused to do that. She just feels it makes her look funny in front of her subordinates, actually. So there's also some cultural kind of thing about those things, actually. If you don't sort of try that out or press people, you don't get those feedback, actually. You feel that I feel naturally comfortable to wear a VR headset, but many people don't see that way, actually. So I'm looking forward to see if there's a VR headset that is lightweight enough and also can be a little bit stylish, people feel comfortable to wear, and also cut the cable, it should be wireless instead of connected to the computer or something, And then we do have those kind of sort of standalone VR headset, but then they're not powerful enough actually to run lots of VR kind of games. So we are still bottlenecked by technology in many ways. Because I feel that when technology is successful, it was always in a situation when some social needs are being met by the technology. This is so when we actually just brought laptops and games to the to South Watertown, we saw it was well welcomed because, you know, it's sufficient at that moment. You don't have to do VR. Yeah, it's sufficient already. Yeah.
Well, also, yeah, because it's such a step change for what they're experiencing anyway. That's all that you need. It's just this, this new ability to engage in a way that you understand and that is fun. And I love the gamification of it as well. Fun is a value. Well, brilliant. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's a really fascinating conversation.
Thank you. And my pleasure to be here as well.
And I really look forward to seeing, well, we'll probably have more conversations, but I really look, I'm going to see if that Watertown experience has propagated anywhere else, because it strikes me as being a really good thing to get out there. But anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you guys for watching. As ever, like and subscribe. And if you like to join our mailing list, please do go to amutri.com and sign up. I've been Adam Sutcliffe, the CPO of Amutri, and this has been Beyond Dimensions. Thank you very much.